Podcast. This is an interview with Jerry Zacharias on April 30th, 2005. Jerry, tell me a little bit about yourself. Tell me your name and your birth date, where you were born, that kind of thing.
Okay, well, I'm Jerry Jones Zacharias, and I was born in Laramie, Wyoming in 1924. So, and my parents were Mamie Carlin Jones, and my dad was Lavelle Jones, and they were from Nebraska, and they had moved to the Grand when I was 8 years old in 1932.
And do you remember that move to Le Grand?
Uh-huh. It was, my dad had it was new at the time. He had a Plymouth, and it was, you know, a four-door Plymouth, and it was like, in that era, they were like a box. They were, you know, real square, and it was kind of a blue-green color, more green than blue, I think, but anyway, it was bluish-green. And my aunt and uncle moved with us, so we came over, my mom and my dad, my aunt and uncle, and me. And I remember stopping at, like instead of motels like we have now, they were called cabins, and they were little individual places with a bedroom, and I don't even remember about the bath. I remember it had a sink, you know, a place where they could cook. I think they fixed, like, breakfast when we'd get up in the morning and then we'd take off. But anyway, that was such a thrill because I always liked to play house, and these little cabins were like playing house like the kids do. But that was really exciting.
Tell me just briefly about your visual impairment. Has that always been with you? Is that something that developed as you progressed in age?
Okay, I was born, my family didn't know this, but I was born with a genetic eye disease called retinitis pigmentosa, which is a deterioration of the retina. And when I was little, I seemed, you know, normal enough that they couldn't see that. I mean, they didn't know I couldn't see, and of course I had nothing to base it on, so I couldn't tell them I didn't see it. But as I got, I got in the first grade in Laramie, Laramie, Wyoming, and the teachers, it was a training school for teachers, and so the student teachers took quite an interest in me because my mother worked in a coffee shop on the campus at the university, and so these college kids knew my family, and they saw me around the campus shop, and so they took quite an interest in me, and they realized that I couldn't see, so they told the school nurse, and they told my parents. And so my parents took me to an eye doctor, and they found out that I was nearsighted. So I started wearing glasses in the first grade. But nobody really, the doctor just said, oh, she's nearsighted, and that was it. And they thought it was because I'd had the measles, a pretty bad case of measles when I was young, so that was, you know, just what they thought. And I could see well enough to play and do the things with other kids. And it was just at school I couldn't see. But I always loved to read, so I read a lot because print in children's books is large. And so I did read a lot. And since I was an only child, I amused myself a lot by reading. And then when I got, when I was in the second grade and we moved to Le Grand, the school was, we hit it right in the middle of the Depression, and the school was not equipped to handle anybody with a handicap. And so my mother would talk to the teachers and say, Jerry can't see very well, could she sit in the front? And I was tall for my age, so the kids would say, oh, I can't see around her, she's too tall. So I was kind of hard, and I'd have to sometimes get up and walk up to the blackboard and read the things that were written there because I couldn't see them that far. But the doctors, they took me to doctors, and they all said, oh, she's just nearsighted, she'll get better as she gets older. And so it's been a gradual thing, and about, years ago, I lost all my sight. But it was gradual all the time I was growing up until, and then finally it just wasn't there.
So how did they, when you got to Le Grand and you were already, they had assumed you were nearsighted, mm-hmm. what kinds of things, did they provide anything else for you other than placing you in the front row and giving you classes?
No.
Were there, how did that affect your learning?
Well, it was hard because, first of all, when I was going to school in Laramie, they stressed reading and spelling and that sort of thing, and they hadn't really gotten into arithmetic. So I mean, we had like adding and subtracting, and that's it. Well, then when we moved to Le Grand, I had 6 weeks of school in Le Grand before the summer, and they were into multiplication tables, and I was way behind, because I'd not had anything like that. I couldn't, so I really got a setback. And then I never got a chance during the summer to get caught up, and when school started, I started backwards again. I mean, I never caught up. I could read and spell with the best of them, but I couldn't do math because I got a bad start to start with, and I couldn't see what I was doing, and I was so far behind, I just couldn't understand it. My parents tried to help me, but my brain just wasn't, because I had a bad start, it was hard to catch up, so I never did. But no, they didn't have any kind of help, no types of, you know, tutoring, or no types. At that time, they didn't have large print, other than the books, the kids' books were. But as I got into, like, actually the second and third grade, the print started, you know, getting a little smaller, because you were starting to get into chapter books, and the textbooks were smaller print. So then I had some problem reading that.
So tell me about your friends in school and social relationships and things like that when you were in grade school. Did that make it difficult to make friends? Did you make friends?
I was really shy. My friends now think that's funny because they can't believe I was ever shy, but I was. It took me a while, but there was one other girl, her name was Nina, and she wore glasses too, and she was fairly outgoing. And so we somehow got together, because there weren't, at that time, there were no other kids in our grade that wore glasses. Well, there was one boy. And the rest of us, there were only the three of us. So we played together, and then because Nina was pretty outgoing, I got acquainted, and then this Jean, the boy, lived near my dad's store, so I got acquainted with him, and I kind of, you know, they understood because they had a little problem too. And but as I got older, I started, kids teased me a lot the first few years, but by the time I got junior high, all of a sudden kids seemed to grow up a little and started to be more understanding, and then they would walk with me because I wouldn't see well enough to always see curbs and things very well. And so the kids were pretty good then. By the time I got in junior high and high school, I fit in better. But I had problems in school because in junior high we had to take PE. And I had to play volleyball, and I couldn't even see the ball till it hit me. And I had to play basketball. Well, I couldn't see that one. I could learn to throw the basket for a free throw, but I couldn't otherwise. And so usually if the ball hit me, I'd just stand there like a dummy. And so nobody wanted me on their team. My best friend Nina was athletic, and she just didn't want, they'd pick a captain and then they'd choose. Well, I was always the last one chosen on the teams, and I felt really, my ego suffered a lot, because I felt like I was dumb and that nobody liked me and stuff.
Now, did you finish all of your schooling then in Le Grand, grade school, junior high, and high school?
Uh-huh.
When did you finish?
I graduated in 1942.
So what kinds of things did you do as time progressed? You said that people became much better and more friendly and understanding to you. So
well, they sometimes would work with me, like they'd try to help me with my homework, and they were, I mean, you know, they couldn't do much, but they'd help try to read some things to me, extra things, and then when we had to go to things, especially after dark, when we'd go to sports things and things at the school, we lived 2 1/4 miles from high school, so we'd have to walk, and none of the kids had cars like they do now, and so we had to walk, and so they'd walk with me, and I don't think I realized how bad my eyes were, and I've always been grateful, because when I was in the 7th grade, my parents bought me a bicycle, and they had no idea that my eyes were as bad as they were, so I could ride fairly well in the daytime, because I had pretty good hearing, and I could hear a car coming, and I had a lot of accidents. I ran into trees, and ran up poles, and ran over curbs, and fell in gravel and things, but I wanted to do it so much, and so we'd ride our bikes from LeGrand to LSL and out in there during the summer several times several times a week, and ride bikes and stuff, because I'd be in the rear. We'd go single file on this country road, and I'd hear the cars coming from the rear, and I'd yell at them, and they saw them coming from the toward us, they'd yell at me, so we'd get right on the edge so that we weren't in the way. So I survived, and I've always been grateful, because otherwise they would never let me have a bicycle if they'd known that I didn't see.
What kinds of social things did you do in school? Well, what did you and your friends do besides things like riding to LSL?
Well, I don't know. I was a spectator sport person. I liked to go to the games, even though I couldn't see them. I liked just the excitement of the the cheers, and everybody had to tell me everything, especially football. He had to tell me who did what, because I couldn't see. I tried so hard to learn about football, but I couldn't even see it. And so anyway, I did go to all those things, and I was active in, I took home economics for a couple of years, and I was active in a club called the Home Ec Club, and that was fun. We used to get together and, you know, had meetings, because we were kind of an active group, we used to be the ones that would serve for some of the banquets and things that they had at the high school, and that was, you know, it was fun. It wasn't maybe the most exciting thing, but we enjoyed it. And I used to babysit some, but they weren't little kids. I had kids usually around 7 or 8 or 9 years old that I babysat with.
Did you date in high school or have boyfriends?
Oh yeah, I had some pretty good crushes.
what kinds of things would you do?
We went to movies, and I wasn't a very good dancer because I couldn't see what they were doing, and I never got the hang of that too much until I got older. But I liked it. But we went to a lot of movies, and I had a lot of crushes on some of the movie people. And when I was real young, I mean, in my grade school years, I was enchanted with Shirley Temple, and I collected Shirley Temple pictures and everything I could get my hands on that had Shirley Temple on it. That was my passion. I still have about 9 scrapbooks of pictures of her. And,
did you see all her movies?
Oh yeah, had to do that.
Were they all presented in LeGrand if they showed up?
Yeah, and so that was fun. I remember there was one little girl. You know how there's always somebody you don't get along with? And this one little girl and I did not get along. So one day she came to school and she said she'd seen Shirley Temple downtown LeGrand, that she was with her parents and they were driving through on their vacation, and that she stopped and went into one of the little shops to get an ice cream cone. I was so envious. I was just like, to this day, I'm not sure it was true, because I can't quite imagine from the things I've read later that you know, that Shirley Temple was pretty well guarded. But anyway, whether she did or didn't, I was so jealous. I was as green as emeralds. Yeah. It was just terrible. But it was, anyway, I did like movies. And I used to like, I took dancing for a while, tap dancing, and I liked that. I didn't do well with ballroom dancing, but I did like tap dance. I wasn't very talented. I was awkward because I was a little tall for my age and I couldn't see what I was doing, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. I liked to pretend I was in the movies and stuff.
Why do you suppose you did better at the tap dancing?
I don't know. I never thought about that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I, you know, it just came easier, I guess. And maybe I wasn't as embarrassed because it was with kids, mostly girls, and I think I was embarrassed with the ballroom dancing. I didn't want to dance with another girl, and I was afraid of the boys. I was afraid I would embarrass myself.
I see. Where would you study or take these dancing classes?
Oh, in those days, it was still, money was real short. So these young girls would take it, and when they were like high school age, they would teach it in their home. It wasn't in a school. It was just like in their, they would open up their living room and let you, or kitchen or wherever, and you danced in their, or basement, whatever they happened to have.
So it wasn't a formal dancing school?
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It was just that these girls were, you know, made money on the side for it. You know, they needed it, and they wanted to teach it, and some of us wanted to learn, so it was kind of fun. Then my girlfriends, and, you know, we'd play theater all the time when we were, you know, young.
What did that involve?
Oh, we just pretend we had a stage, and some of us would be the audience, and some of us would be the entertainers. We were really silly. So we had a lot of fun. We were known as my friend Nina and myself and one other friend named Donna were known as the Gigglers, and I was always getting in trouble because all we had to do was look at each other and we would just go into torrents of giggles. And then one of us would get sent to the cloakroom. Whichever one hadn't been sent the day before got sent that day.
Oh. Now, what is the cloakroom?
This day and age you don't have them because the rooms are all open, but instead of lockers, they just had a hallway that was at one end of the room, and there were hooks for your coats and stuff like that, and your lunch buckets and what have you. And so anyway, whenever I got into a peal of giggling, I got to see the cloakroom.
And how long would you have to stay there?
Oh, I don't know, until the teacher decided to let me come back. I guess until she decided I was through giggling.
Huh. So that was a punishment, that sort of thing.
Oh, yes.
Doesn't sound like it worked.
It didn't. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It didn't.
Mm-hmm. What other things did you do in school, high school, around town? Or?
Well, I worked in my dad's store. He had in the third grade, he bought the summer before third grade, he bought a little grocery store. And I was pretty young, but he'd let me help in the, they had a candy counter, and he'd let me help because it was across the street from Greenwood School. So at like Saturdays and stuff, the kids would come in to buy candy, and I could sell candy. So I learned how to work in the store, and then as I got older, I worked there, you know, more and more as I got older and could do better with money and what have you.
Did that become a part-time job, or was that just helping out?
It was just
family?
Helping out. I didn't get paid. I just helped. Mm-hmm. Like when my dad, he would take some groceries to deliver them, so I could run the store while he delivered them. Because my mother was busy while I was young. We had this 3 acres and had a huge garden, and so Mom would work in the yard and the garden and do canning and all that stuff, so she was working very hard, so she couldn't really spare the time to come up so in the summer, I worked in the store. In the winter, I didn't.
Tell me about running the candy counter. What did that involve, and what things were there?
Oh, well, like candy bars that you pay a dollar for now were 5 cents, and they had wonderful ones. Like, well, I think they still have you know Lars, I'm pretty sure you do.
Yeah.
And I had mounds, I think. And then they had some things they called pippins, and they were probably, though they were as big around, they were more like a, oh, I can't think what they call it. Anyway, they were chocolate with a, like an orange or a cream filling, and they were as big around as, almost as big around as a cupcake, but not that tall, but big around and puffed up and maybe an inch instead of like a cupcake, which is a couple inches. And anyway, they sold for a penny a piece, and now if you saw them, they'd be paid 50 cents or something like that at least, or maybe a dollar. And they were really good chocolate. They had a candy bar called Bat Bar. I mean, a candy sucker called the Bat. It was called the Bat, and it was a kind of a square caramel type of stuff. And it was long, not square, but rectangle, I guess, because it was long and maybe an inch in diameter, and about 4 or 5 inches long, sold for a penny a piece, and the kids would buy them by the dozens. They loved them because you really got your money's worth, and the kids would come in the store and just buy. My dad couldn't keep them hardly in the store. He'd buy big boxes of them every delivery, and they just sell out real fast. And then, of course, they had the nickel bars, but mostly penny candy was what we sold at the store. Lots of penny candy. And they had the long strings of licorice, and I don't remember because I mostly liked the chocolate pippins. That was my favorite.
Did you, you said you babysat a little bit and you mm-hmm. worked in your father's store. Did you work for employment anywhere while you were in up till high school?
Oh, just occasional babysitting. I'd get like 25 cents an hour, something like that, I think, which was pretty good pay in those days.
Did you go to college?
Yeah.
Where did you go?
I went to Eastern Oregon.
What did you study?
More or less just general studies. The first year I went, it was right out of high school, and my eyes were getting worse and worse and worse, and I couldn't see what I was doing, and I had a terrible time, but my dream was to be a dietitian. And they said you had to take a lot of math and chemistry. So I took math, which was my worst subject, and of course chemistry was no better. So I spent my first year doing some English and things that were required, but I did quite a bit of math and chemistry. So it was very difficult for me. And I got C grades, which really made me feel bad because I really liked to have better grades, but I couldn't see to read the assignments, so I just sort of read part of it and bluff my way through, and somehow I made it, I don't know how. And then at the end of that year, in the meantime, before I went to college, right out of high school, I met Dale, and I fell madly in love with him.
Now, who is Dale?
Dale Zacharias, and he was born in Pendleton, so it was kind of this other side of the mountain thing, because I was living in the Grand, and he lived here. And he was 2 years older than I was, so he was working over here at the, they used to have a cannery here, and he worked at that. And he was waiting to go into the military. He had signed up, but he hadn't had his call yet.
Now, was he a student at Eastern also?
No.
Is that how you met him?
No, I met him through mutual friends. I had come to Pendleton with a friend of mine, and we saw friends of hers that I knew too, and he was with them, and we just met, you know, that way. Mm-hmm. So it was just some friends. So anyway, I went to school, and he went off to the Navy, and so I got through 1 year, and that summer, I didn't see him that whole year. He was off in Oklahoma and San Diego and different places, because he was studying to be an aviation machinist mate, and so they sent him to Norman, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma City, and so on. So anyway, his mother, when he went from Oklahoma to San Francisco, he got the word that he was going overseas. And of course, in those days, they didn't tell you anything like now. I mean, it was all big hush-hush, but they did tell him they were going overseas, but they had no idea where. So he wanted his mother and me to come see him, so we went to San Francisco to see him. And anyway, against everybody else's approval, we got married. I sort of eloped, because I didn't tell my parents until I had already married him. And so it was not a, you know, it was kind of sad, because I didn't want to hurt my parents, but I was so crazy about him, I couldn't, because I didn't know how long I'd have with him. And it wasn't like today where you live with somebody and stuff, nobody'd think about it. I mean, I wanted to be with him every minute, and the only way I could see that it would be proper would be to be married. And I, of course, I thought that was fine. But I didn't have any idea whether I'd have a day with him or a week with him or a month or what. So we got married and we found a little apartment in San Francisco, and we were there exactly a month, and he got shipped out.
So, did you come home?
And then I came home, but I didn't want to go to college because it had been so hard for me. So I worked, I got a job in a bookstore. Of course, the only thing bad about that was that I, because I could see well enough then to see the price on the books, and I could always ask one of the other help anyway, and I could see the titles and stuff, so I did all right in that. But then finally, we decided that my mother needed, she started to work at the bank somewhere along in there, and was already working in the bank, so she decided that if I would do the housework and cooking at home, that would be good experience for me, and it would also help her. So instead of me paying them for me staying there, I just did all the work, and that helped both of us, so that's what I did.
Now, they knew you were married by then.
Oh yeah,
right.
I told them right away. Uh-huh. I knew that if I called them and asked them if I could get married, they would have said no, because
right.
I was too young. Mm-hmm. And I was 19, but I wasn't terribly mature, I don't guess. I mean, I must not have been. But anyway, so I did that. And then I didn't see Dale. He was gone 21 months before I saw him again. So by the time he came home and everything, so much had changed in a lot of ways, because we were real happy when he first came home, but for a while I was with him while he was in the Navy. He was stationed, he was stationed in Corvallis, Oregon, so we went down there and everything was fine. But when he got discharged in 1945, everybody needed a job. Everybody was coming home. Everybody needed a place to live, and we couldn't find anything. And in the meantime, his mother had died and his father had moved away. And so we kind of had to stay around Le Grand because we didn't really have any place to stay. And so my folks let us stay with them for a while. And then my dad needed help, and this time he'd moved to Union and had a furniture hardware store. So he needed help, so Dale worked for him. And that just didn't work. About that time I got pregnant, and it was just all of us living in the same house. My grandmother came to live with us, and it was just too crowded. And so right after my daughter was born, he wanted to go to school, and so that, because he didn't like a store, he didn't, you know, it just doesn't work working with relatives sometimes. And so he wanted to go to school, and the school for an aviation machinist, and the school was in San Diego. So we made arrangements for him to go. And then while he was gone, I was supposed to go down there. Well, my mother and my dad, my family all said, oh, you can't go down there and take this baby down there because you can't see well enough and something might happen to her. And I was terrified. So I left Dale. I told him I didn't want to be married anymore. I loved him, but I couldn't bear the apron strings apart.
Let's go back to your college days again then. You didn't complete college?
Not then.
Uh-huh.
But then later, after my daughter, was about in the second grade, we didn't have television then or anything. It was just beginning to be in Union County. So this would have been about 1955. I decided that I couldn't depend on her. I didn't want to hold her back by having her have to take me places and do things for me. And so I decided to go get a guide dog, which seemed like a good step, which it was. And so I went to California, and I got a guide dog named Sheila. And so when I got this dog, my daughter and I would go places and you know, go shopping and stuff after school, and everything was fine. But then she started coming home from school in the second grade, knowing more than I did about what was going on, because by that time I couldn't see to read the newspaper. We didn't have television. Radio station didn't really have much on it, but it was anything that I was learning very much. So I decided to take a class at the college after I'd gotten
there. Continue the interview with Jerry Zacharias. It is April 30th, 2005. So you're talking about your new guide dog, Sheila,
mm-hmm.
and you took a class. You took a class at Eastern.
Right. And by this time, I found out that because the doctor had diagnosed me with retinitis pigmentosa, and I was called legally blind, so that's why I could get the dog. I still had some vision, but I couldn't really see to get around. It's a strange thing. I could see inside the house, but when I went out in the sun or the dark, I couldn't see either way. I couldn't see at all. So anyway, I took this class, and I had a friend that took it with me, and she read the lessons to me, and we studied together, and we did so well in the class that we both got A's. So that excited me, so I decided that I'd like to take some more classes. So I talked to the school, and I decided to take, I didn't go on any plan. I didn't work toward graduation. I just decided I wanted to take things that were interesting, and also I wanted teachers that would understand that I couldn't see. I didn't want to be babied, but I wanted them to understand that I had to have readers, and at this time I could get readers. The state would pay for me to have another student or somebody to read to me.
Tell me what that means, getting a reader.
It means that, like now, everything can be taped, and you can have a book on tape. I get books from the Library for the Blind all the time that are on tape. But at that time, they didn't have the tapes. That was, this wasn't. And so they had records, but they weren't as easy to make. So anyway, the state would provide you they would pay another student to read to you. So they'd read all your lessons to you. And so I arranged to have, the teachers would help me find somebody in the class that was willing to read to me. And they'd come to my home, or we'd go to the study hall at college and read and study together. So and then my grades were good, because it got so that instead of just one reader, kids from the dorm liked to come to my house because they got away from it, from the dorm a little bit, and I'd feed them goodies. So they'd come to my house, and I'd have kids sitting around the dining room table. We'd sit there and read, and like if any of us had a question, we'd stop reading. And I mean, they'd read, and any of us had a question, we'd stop and discuss it. And so we all got really good grades.
And in this group that used to show up at your house?
Yeah, we were all in the same classes, and so we all got really good grades. So I went, I took like maybe just two classes a term, because I had a household. I had my home, and I had things to do, and I had a daughter that was in school, and so I couldn't really afford the time to take more than two, but I'd take two classes at a time. And I got up to, I think I have about probably a half a year of college left that I didn't finish, but I got that far, and I really enjoyed it. But I finally kind of got burned out, and about that time my daughter graduated and left, and that broke my heart, because she was an only child, and the empty nest thing just about killed me. But I did enjoy going to the college, and all the instructors were so helpful, because they would see that I got good kids to, and I met so many young, nice young kids. Because see, I was in my 30s by that time, and these kids were, you know, 18, 19 years old, and they were so good to read to me. It was great.
Did you know of a term that sometimes used to be used at Eastern called townie?
Mm-hmm.
The people who were here,
oh,
were
yeah.
you considered a townie then?
Mm-hmm.
And so they were just glad to get out of the dorm and go
right.
somewhere.
Uh-huh. They were thrilled to come, because they were in the dorm all the time, and they'd come to our house.
Did you eventually follow a degree path of some sort? Did you continue to just take the classes
I just
that
took
interested you?
Yeah, I just took general studies. I took, I liked history real well, so I took quite a bit of history. I took some sociology, and I took some economics, and I think the social studies or something. Anyway, it included geography, and one of the girls that read to me was wonderful, because she'd make copies of these maps, and I still had some vision at this time. So, anyway, she'd make maps of the countries that we were studying, and she'd make them big, and then do them in bright colors so that I could get an idea of the geography, which I had never been able to do, because when I was young, my mother would always point to the globe and say, now here's such and such, well, I could barely see the continent, let alone the, you know, the little countries involved. So this was wonderful, because I really learned a lot by doing this, because Nancy was so good at making my maps, and by studying with these other students, I learned so much that I just felt like I came into a new world, because I was really not that bright before. You know, what I had read before was so difficult.
Did you do other things with these younger students then besides study?
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like you socialized a lot.
We did. Some of them went to the same church I did, and sometimes they'd come on weekends and we'd do things. I can't think. I know that we went to some weddings and we went to some social things. I can't remember just what. I know that if there were things going on in Le Grand, we'd take, you know, go. And I still went to movies, so we'd go to things like that once in a while.
Did you ever meet any other visually impaired person on campus? Did anybody else ever attend Eastern that you could be friends with, or at least exchange points of view?
Not at that time, but that reminds me of something in high school. When I was a senior in high school, I was taking a class, history class, from Lee Johnson, who was from Le Grand. In fact, I think he was a history teacher, but he also, you know, I think he wrote a book. I know he wrote a book about Le Grand. But anyway, he was teaching, and so this young girl came into class this my senior year, and she was totally blind and used a cane, but couldn't get around real well because she hadn't had a chance to really get cane mobility. They weren't really good at teaching cane mobility in those days. She had been to the school for the blind, but they hadn't really taught her. She knew some cane mobility, but not really where she was comfortable with it. So anyway, she needed somebody to walk her to and from school. And she asked me if I could do it. So, I mean, I could, and I didn't know I couldn't see that much. And so I walked by our house and walked her to school every day and take her home in the afternoon. And one time I missed the corner and she said, hey, we missed the corner. But it was rather ironic that the only totally blind person I knew asked me to help her, but I, you know, like I say, I was only legally blind then, but I didn't know I was legally blind until a few years later.
Did you continue your friendship over the years?
We did until, well, she moved to Portland, and I was in the Grand, and then later Bill and I moved to Seattle, and so I didn't keep in touch, but I used to occasionally run into her in Portland to get to see her.
Tell me about using your seeing eye dog now to get around town in the Grand. Didn't that open up a lot more opportunities for you?
Oh, yes. Well, when I went down to get a dog, I had absolutely no idea what a guide dog did. I mean, I had a friend who worked for the State Commission for the Blind, and she had a guide dog. So I knew that she got around all over the country and everything, and I thought, oh, that would be, you know, really, I never thought it would that it would mean me that I could do that. And so one time I asked her, because she worked at the Commission for the Blind, and I asked her if she thought I'd be eligible for a guide dog. So she signed sent an application in for me and signed it and everything. And of course, I had to have a doctor's, I had to have the doctor, the eye doctor, say that besides her, I had to have two people do it. So anyway, I decided to go down and get this dog. Well, it was actually 50 years ago today that I went down to get my first dog. So I had to go to San Rafael, California. And I got down there and I thought, what am I doing? They took me to this dormitory. The guide dog person met me and took me to the dorm. And I thought, what am I doing here? I didn't even really care an awful lot about dogs at that time. I mean, I liked them, but they weren't part of my life. And I thought, I'm going to get a dog, and I might have to have one the rest of my life. Mm. Excuse me, I'll try to get
a break.
I didn't even know for sure what a dog did. I mean, I'd see him on a harness, but I didn't know what to do. And I knew that they were supposed to save you from getting run over, but outside of that, I didn't know anything. So I found out that the dog works like, first they keep you for a few days and find out kind of what you do, and the dog, they pick the right dog for you, one that's the right speed and right size and all that. So I got this lovely black lab, Sheila, and then you have to kind of bond. So everything you did at the dorm, you had to do it with your dog, and I had to stay there 4 weeks. So when you went to the dining room, you took your dog, and when you went in to take a shower, you took your dog. The dog didn't take a shower, but it'd go in the room and in the bathroom with you, and you just get bonded. So the dog, then they take you out for like a block or two at a time, and the dog is taught to stop at the curb so that you don't step out into the street and fall. They stop at the curb, and then you can tell the dog right, left, or forward, and whichever way you want to go. The dog knows that it knows right from left and forward, so you just do that. And then you learn that, like, if people have cars parked across the sidewalk, or there's a bicycle on the sidewalk, they're trained to go around those things. Or if there's construction, they'll go around it. Or if they can't go around it, they'll stop. And then sometimes I turn around and go back and try the other side of the street. Like now, there's a sidewalk or a yard that's all torn up down where I walk. So I just go on the other side of the street now until I get it finished. But anyway, it was amazing. And when I would walk, before I got the dog, I would be walking down the street, and there were people that had dogs that would lay on the sidewalk in the summer, and they'd be nice and cool. And I stepped right on the dogs, and the dogs go roaring into the house. None of them ever bit me. I can't understand it, but none of them ever growled at me. They just ran yipping away, and I felt so embarrassed with the dog. Those things didn't happen.
So you brought Sheila back to LeGrand.
Right, after 4 weeks of school, I came back to LeGrand, and I felt like I was a new person, because they, one of the things toward the end of the training was that we walked across the Golden Gate Bridge. And to think that here I am, walking up there on this bridge with traffic going zooming by on one side and the drop off into the water on the other side. I mean, I knew there were fences, but it still was really exciting to do that. And so I got home, and my dog was such a speedy dog that I practically ran. Everybody was laughing because we just practically ran everywhere we went. And my daughter would come running along behind me. It was a wonderful experience.
What kinds of things did that free you up to do once you got back home with your dog? What things could you do that you didn't do before?
Well, for one thing, I could go shopping by myself, and I could go visit friends. I didn't have to have help. I could do it in the day while my husband was at work, and while my daughter was at school, I could, or like if I wanted to go to something at school to see my daughter, like PTA or something, I could take my dog and walk. And like in the daytime, I'd walk places, or I could, after my parents moved to Le Grand again, I could walk down and visit them. And
were you able to work? Did you work?
I didn't work then. When we moved to Seattle, I worked.
I see.
But I didn't work in Le Grand.
Uh-huh.
And I just never thought about it. But I went to Seattle and took some training and learned, and was a receptionist at the Library for the Blind for 10 years. But anyway, in Le Grand, I was busy. My daughter was still at home, and it was just nice being a at-home mom.
Briefly here.
Okay.
So you had Sheila, but you were in Le Grand quite a bit of time there, I think about 30 years or
right.
so before you came over to Pendleton. How many dogs did you have?
Well, in Le Grand, I had three. I had my first two were black. I had Sheila was a female black lab, and my second dog was, ironically, it was named Dale, and he was black lab male. And then I had a male golden retriever named Wally. And I had, with Wally, it was fun. It was right after my daughter left to go to college. And I was out on the front porch brushing my dog one day, and this little boy came up, and to be truthful, I can't think of the boy's name right now, but anyway, he was about five, and he said, could I come in and visit? And I thought, I don't know if this is a very good idea. Nowadays you wouldn't do that, but I said, well, okay, if you behave, you can come in. So he came in, and then he said, can we have tea? So I made tea, very weak tea, like Cambridge tea. And I, so every day, or almost every day, he'd come by and we'd have tea. So that was one thing that a dog will make friends. When I first moved to Pendleton, I was not happy because the first people I met didn't really care much for dogs. And they would say, oh, you don't have to take your dog, we'll help you. And that dog got to retirement age, and I almost didn't get another dog. And then Dale wouldn't make my decision for me, so I finally decided, I guess I would, because I'd meet doggy people, and I have. I've got lots of friends, and they like my dog, and life's wonderful with it. But anyway, in Le Grand, I had Molly, and that was the dog I had with the little boyfriend I had. And he was my boyfriend until one day after school started, I came over, and he says, well, I won't be coming over to have tea anymore because I've got a girlfriend.
Oh.
So I got dropped.
Oh, boy. Now, what kind of, there must be some adventures or tales that you must have gotten into with your dog.
Oh, yes.
Want to share a few of those?
One of them, when I was going to college with Sheila, she was trained, they're trained to go around obstacles. So I was walking on the campus, and some man was putting in some new sidewalk. and he had put up some sawhorses. And so my dog went around the sawhorse, and we've gotten these wet cement, because she didn't know that it was wet cement. So he came running out. He was very unhappy with us because we left our footprints in his cement. But she did what she was trained to do. And another thing that a dog will do, and just people don't understand this, they're trained to go to the curb. And if somebody's standing in their way, they're apt to just come up and just sort of nudge you out of the way. And because the dogs don't necessarily have manners, they're trained to go to a curb, or they're trained to go to a counter in a store. And if somebody's standing at the counter, they can be rude, they can push you out of the way there too. So it's kind of embarrassing at times.
But did that happen?
It has happened many times.
And what people don't understand what's going on in that particular
they don't,
case?
Well, you know, they don't always understand, but usually when they see the dog, well, they don't get, most of them don't get mad or anything.
Uh-huh.
It was rather embarrassing when I had my Golden, because it was right about the time miniskirts came out, and he'd be going into the check counter of the store, and his nose was right about where the skirt left off. And these girls, I mean, they wouldn't see me coming, and then the dog would put his cold nose on their bare leg, and they'd go, ah, and then they'd see me, and then everything was okay. But
you mean in order to get him out of the way?
Well, no, just friendly, just, well, he didn't do it on purpose. He wasn't really sniffing or anything. He just happened to he was tall enough that his nose just hit right their bare leg, and then as he'd go up to the counter, he'd just look at them, I guess, you know, and catch their leg. But most of them were pretty understanding.
Now, are the dogs trained to protect as well?
No. They're not supposed to, although they probably would if you needed them. I mean, I asked one of the instructors, and they said that they don't train them to be, but they said because they bonded with you, they very well could. But on the other hand, they might lick them to death. You don't know what, you just don't know.
Right.
But mostly a dog is intimidating enough that not everybody's going to bother you. And I have had a couple dogs that I'm sure would have protected me, and my current one probably would.
Did anything ever occur that the dog might have really kept you from danger then at any time?
Oh, several times when I've not heard the traffic. See, the dog stops at the curb, and then you listen to hear the traffic and tell the dog, like, if you want to go forward. You tell, when you want to cross that street, you tell them forward. And I have made the mistake a few times, not hearing a car because some of them were so quiet, or there'd be other noise and I wouldn't hear it, or sometimes somebody would make a turn and came awfully close to hitting me, and the dog will stop. They're told to, they call it intelligent disobedience, that they'll pull you back or stop to keep you from getting run over.
So the dog can see this traffic, mm-hmm. and they know when something's coming that they shouldn't put you in.
Well, it's always, yeah, of course, it's usually that if the car is coming from the left side where the dog is, and of course the dog doesn't want to get hit either, but then they've been trained, and that's what they're supposed to do, is to protect you.
Now the dog is trained to stay on one side of you?
They're always on the left, unless you have a disability where you have to have it on your right, but that's standard for, you know, dogs, like show dogs and everything,
that is right?
On the left. And she, one time when I was walking across the Main Street Bridge here, a big gust of wind came up, and it was blowing toward me, I mean, pushing me toward the street, and there's not a railing there, you know, but there's a railing on the river. So she just jumped at me and shoved me over toward the railing. I don't know, I mean, that surprised me, but it kept me from blowing out into the street where there was traffic, so I thought that was pretty neat. And she is good to go to concerts, and we went to the play at the college the other night. We used to go to a lot of things like that, in the grand concerts and plays, and the dogs are always well-behaved person.
Now, I've been told by another person that I interviewed that, I don't remember now if you came to her classroom or it was a general assembly at the school over in Union to talk about your dog. But I understand you've done quite a bit of this.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what that involves.
Well, it depends on your audience.
These would have been elementary school, probably first and second graders in Union.
Okay, I kind of remember that. I didn't remember her name. I think you mentioned it, but I didn't remember her name. But I went because a friend of mine asked the teacher if I could come and talk to their kids. Usually we talk to them about third or fourth grade is usually, although I've been to younger ones. But the younger ones don't really understand about a guide dog. They just want to see a puppy, you know.
Right.
But when I go to talk to kids that are older, you know, explain them what the dog does and how to treat them, and they're not supposed to stop and pet you along the way and get your dog all excited. I mean, pet your dog, you know, and not get you all excited and have the get lost. Because you can stand talking to somebody on the sidewalk and it's normal to kind of wiggle around. You don't just stand in one spot like military. You move your feet and next thing you know you're turned around. And if you do that, then they walk off, your friends walk off, and you start out, you're apt to be turned in the wrong direction and you're not going to end up where you're supposed to. So it's not a good habit to do that. And we always tell them things like that. We tell them that they need to learn to clean up after their own dogs, and they need to not feed the dogs anything. I don't want my dog fed because she's on her own diet, and I want to keep her weight just right. And but I do let them pet her if they ask me, and the conditions are okay. I'll let people pet her.
So you have quite a friendly dog here today.
Mm-hmm.
She's different than when she's on the street
when
with
she
you
puts
or when she's working, I guess.
Okay, she wears a harness, and when she puts the harness on, she's supposed to know she's working. And it makes a big difference. And she likes to work. I get her harness and she comes running. But as soon as I get home, her harness comes off and she's just a dog then. So she doesn't necessarily heed all manners any more than a spoiled dog would.
Well, I was going to describe that for the tape because I now what's her name? This
her name's Rosie.
Rosie, I met her at the door. She's met me at the door, and she didn't remind me of a
working dog.
A working dog at all. She's really a good leaper, and so as soon as that harness comes on, she wouldn't be like that at all.
But she's not supposed to. Once in a while, she forgets, but she's really pretty good at that. And she's good, like, at public places. Like, I went to the play at the other night, and we were sitting right by the orchestra, and she just laid down and slept through the whole thing. Didn't even, even the percussion instruments didn't bother her.
Didn't make her wake up.
Uh-uh.
So, more about LeGrand then. You were telling me, if you want to talk about it, let me see how much run we've got here. We'll have to go into another tape here in a moment. But you said that your impairment has presented other problems from time to time, and you were telling me about your daughter in the bus station one day. I'm assuming this might have been before you had a guide dog and the man made off with your baby and went into the bus station in Union.
Yeah, right. Well, I was waiting for the bus to go to LeGrand from Union, and it was at Sank's Cafe, which was on the main street of Union, and I had my baby in my arms. She was probably about 18 months old, maybe, I don't know. And all of a sudden, she was so friendly that this guy came up, and I didn't realize it, but next thing I knew, he picked her up and carried her in Shank's Cafe and was going to buy her an ice cream cone. Well, if that had been now, I'd have had a heart attack. I followed him, and I got her back, but it scared me. And, you know, you think he could just come up and take her away from me like that. He wasn't mean or anything. He just took her, and he said he was going to buy her ice cream. Well, I believed him at that time because I was more naive, and besides, things aren't as, weren't probably as bad as they are now, but it scared me. But Kay was, my daughter Kay was very gregarious when she was, you know, was little, and she liked everybody. And oh, some of the things that have happened through the years when I got my first dog that's changed a lot since then was that there were places that you're supposed to be able to go, it's a law that you can go to restaurants and places, but I was told to leave several times in restaurants because I just get in the door and they say you can't bring the dog in, and I had a copy of the law and they wouldn't even read it, and they just say nope, you can't. And I could have made a big issue, but I didn't. But technically now I don't know what it is, but there's a big fine for them telling you to leave.
Oh, you mean if they don't cooperate with the law?
If they don't accept you, and there's a restaurant here in Pendleton that says, well, they have to do it, but they would rather I didn't bring my dog in, so I don't go there. I just don't make an issue of it. I just don't trade there.
And you said that happened to you in LeGrand?
But it happened in LeGrand and Union. Not in Union. It didn't happen in Union. But it happened in LeGrand several different times, and then, you know, other places I'd go, it would happen. You don't see that happening much anymore because I think people know more about guide dogs and stuff. And another thing about being impaired, like I said, I like to read, and so I get all my books on tape now, and get magazines and things in Braille that I can read. But my mother also has, you know, she has macular degeneration, and she gets the taped books too. They're really wonderful.
Now, did you did any of that hit the LeGrand Library? Did you utilize the library there or the university for that?
No, they didn't have anything like that at the school. But I got the books from the state library in Salem provides the books for the state. Actually, they come out of the Library of Congress, and then each state has their own regional library that serves all the print impaired people. So I get all mine from Salem. Now, of course, you can buy or rent recorded books in a lot of places, but they're not quite, but the ones that I get from the library aren't, for the Library for the Blind, aren't condensed, and so many of them you get. If you buy them and stuff, they're condensed.
We're going to run out of tape here. Okay.